Well, good afternoon. That's a happy group. That's a good thing to hear. My name is Kurt Dewhurst, and along with John Beck, I co-direct the Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives program. As most of you know, John does most of the work with the Brown Bag series, so we do consult and plan. But John would have been here with us, and up until last night, thought he would. John's been in D.C., where there's been some snow, and he emailed me on Saturday and said, I still should be able to make it because the flight is on Sunday at noon or afternoon, and they're supposed to reopen the airports, but obviously that hasn't happened. So you'll have to just imagine I'm John Beck. That's very hard, I'm sure, for you to do, but I'll do my best to carry on for John today. I'm very pleased to have you with us. There are some sign-in sheets around. I hope you will. There should be one in each kind of aisle. If you can make sure you sign in so we make sure we capture your contact information and stay in touch with you for future activities. Also wanted to make a couple of other brief announcements for you. In case you didn't notice it coming in, if you're interested in a copy of the presentation, well, some of a related paper connected to our presentation today, John Rivette has kindly brought some copies here, so please feel free to take one on the back table there, and any other handouts there. I also want to call to your attention that if you haven't had a chance to see it, the exhibition Iron Hulls and Turbulent Waters, Ore Boats, Workers in Great Lake Shipping is still on in the MSU Museum, but will be closing shortly. It's on the ground floor of the museum. I urge you to take a moment to see it. And also, while you're here, take a moment to see a couple of the other new exhibitions that have recently opened at the museum. Our next Brown Bag event will be on Friday, February 19th. It is a performance. It's called A Thread Woven Through Our Lives, Music and Family, Work and Labor by Sheila K. Adams, a folk singer. And this will not be in the MSU Museum, but will be on the fourth floor west of the MSU Library. There's a flyer for it back there. It's mentioned also in the larger summary of upcoming events. I'm not going to go through those with you right now. So it's really my pleasure, though, to have the opportunity to introduce a friend and colleague who I've had the pleasure of working with for many years at the MSU Museum in a number of different contexts. Many of you know John Rivette for his role in the School of Human Resources and Labor Relations. He's now the professor emeritus of Work, Leisure, and Labor Studies. John has retired about 3 years ago. He's had a really distinguished career in labor history. I won't chronicle all of that. Some of you also know him as being in the past, our faculty grievance officer at MSU, or as heading up the Meet Michigan program, which oriented new faculty to the state of Michigan. John also probably is especially well known, perhaps by some of you, for the work he's done on oral histories related to Detroit labor stories. Well over 100 of those now in the Voice Library is a strong working relationship over the years with the MSU Voice Library. He also has done some interesting recent work about the way in which the Mackinac Center can approach, let's say, seeking information, FOIAing labor education programs across the state of Michigan at major universities. In labor studies initiatives in our state. John's talk today will be an interesting one in lots of ways, but we're also going to be joined by Skype with a colleague, and John will say a bit about that in a minute. But please join me in welcoming John, who's going to be the name of his talk today is Building the Other UAW, the Allied Industrial Workers in Michigan and the Midwest. Please join me in welcoming John Rivette.
So thank you very much. I know all of you but one, I think. So otherwise, I would have people introduce themselves. But up in the corner, they're a little small, is Ken Germanson. And Ken and I have known each other since maybe the late 70s. On and off, we've related to this project about the Allied Industrial Workers. Dr. Lisa Fine was a colleague, and we had some conversations and maybe even took out some papers at some time related to this project. So it's been a long time. Ken and I have been working on this. And I'll say at the end, but I'll do it now. I think both of us would hope, Ken and I would hope, that some professional papers and or video come out of this. So one of the problems today, or one of the unique things, is that Ken is obviously up there in Milwaukee, and I'm here. And between our different health and other issues, we haven't really gone through this show. So this is a pilot test kind of a possibility of a slideshow and a chance to talk about the Allied industrial workers. So as Kirk said, my name and all that business used to be called School of Labor Industrial Relations. It's more an HR school than a labor relations school today. And John Beck has been involved with the school probably since late 80s. On the last page of the handout, and if you didn't get it, there's a kind of preliminary handout on the back. I also list my website, which I'm using mostly as business cards. And I have two things to mention about this, because on my website on the left side is a media column, and these videos I was involved with on Detroit and Michigan labor history and some others are all up online on that so people can use them. The universities here at Wayne State and MSU used to be involved but weren't interested any more than trying to sell that kind of stuff, so I just put them online. And on the right-hand side is something called publications, but it's more a list of projects and a few papers that I've given. So, as it says on the top, Ken Jermanson's president emeritus of the Wisconsin Labor History Society, former editor of the Allied Industrial Workers International Union. And Ken, that picture is not as clear. You sent it to me, but I think we'll need to fix that. But I'll say just a couple more things. This was a paper that Ken did while he was editor, kind of a summary about the Allied Industrial Workers. And he can tell us more about his career as we get into talking about the history of the union. He's done a variety of other things. He actually was with the newspapers and got involved in a newspaper strike before working for AIW. He then, a little bit more recently, got involved with the Wisconsin Labor History Society, as it said on the previous slide, president emeritus of that, and I'm going the wrong way. But on that list is what it says. This newsletter and the conferences they put on are all still Ken Jermanson, as far as I can tell. He's president emeritus, only that there's other people's names with other lists there. So they do various kind of articles and topics. They did one on School for Workers, which was kind of the model for the MSU labor education program that used to exist. And I'll mention later, and I guess Kurt already did, part of my job originally was to work in labor education programs. And I probably met Ken when I was doing stuff with people for School of Workers over in Wisconsin. So our topics today are to cover these areas, and depending on how much time it is, we'll see how much I do on Lansing and 182. But a number of our kind of stories kind of go in and out of that. And later, I think I have a picture of Lisa's book, but I brought it in case anyone isn't familiar with Rio Joe. Chapter 3 has a lot, I think it's 3, has a lot of details on this gentleman, Lester Washburn, who is the original president of the original amalgamated Local 182, which later becomes an AIW, but really kind of the parent of all of the Lansing auto worker unions. So those are the kind of topics. And Ken, do you want to start anything you want to add about yourself or get going into the first topic there?
Really, other than to point out that, and I hope my voice comes through okay.
You're coming through fine, I think.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to say it's been fun working with John, who I met years ago when we held some some labor education classes over at Michigan State. And I started out as a newspaper reporter and kind of thought that was going to be my career. However, after my Navy service, I ended up at the Milwaukee Sentinel, which was at that time a first paper, and almost immediately ended up on the bargaining committee and the executive board. Largely, I think, by default, since nobody else wanted to do it, I guess. So the result was that we went out on strike in 1962, and at that point, the employer had offered us a raise, just to put this into perspective, of 10 cents for each of 2 years. Now, that was okay with us. We thought that was halfway decent. But we wanted to convert the second year into the beginning of a pension plan for ourselves. And that's where we walked. We ended up on a strike. And it was one of the most, we were out for 10 weeks. And at that time, the Milwaukee Journal, which was the opposing newspaper in town at that time, bought the Sentinel, thus ending the strike. And I won't go into the detail. But the interesting part of that was they needed to put out a morning paper. So they hired everybody out of the newsroom, with the exception of about a dozen of us. Half of us were alcoholics or ne'er-do-wells otherwise. I was neither at that point. And I was on the bargaining committee. And no bargaining committee members were hired. That was the kind of labor relations that would go on everywhere. And those were things to be expected. And eventually I ended up as 4 years as a representative for state, county, and municipal employees in the city of Milwaukee, representing basically all the blue collar trades there, which was about 3,500 members. And it was at the time when we had just bargained the collective bargaining law in Wisconsin, which was, as I think some of you know, the first public employee collective bargaining law in the country that had any meat in it. And we bargained a number of first contracts, and eventually I went to the Allied Industrial Workers in 1968. And as their editor and political action director, and after about 10 years, became assistant to the international president, where I was until 1992. Now, I'm not sure how pertinent that all is, but the AIW had principal membership in Western Michigan, mainly Lansing, Muskegon, Battle Creek, and up in the Ludington area. And I obviously got over here quite a lot. We are the other UAW. We are the original UAW, I would like to stress. And I don't know whether, John, I should go into that whole history or not at this point, or just, or do you want to interject anything?
Well, as Ken and I talked, I'm going to kind of let this conversation go. I would include you, but I'll have enough trouble timing just Ken and I. But we will save some time at the end for questions and answers if somebody gives me a note about 1 o'clock or something, some kind of notice, so I do that. So the story until kind of the bottom three here precedes Ken, but because of his unique role and because of mine doing labor history, we've looked into this, and we have all kinds of documents like labor papers. This is the Lansing Labor News, but the complete collection of these are now here at MSU in special collections. There are things like proceedings of international conventions. I have the 47 one from AIW. I have a Michigan AFL one from 49. And I'll pass a couple of those around just for those that aren't familiar with what some of those kind of artifacts look like. In addition, Ken and I have done a number of interviews, and while this is at the end, I'm betting we'll never get there, so I'll just mention it now. On the last page of the handout, we list some of the kind of references that we use. Both Ken and I have interviewed different people related to the AIW story, and some of that is in the voice library at MSU in just audio form. We also have done some interviews and some things on video. So we have things like I have here an old VHS that relates to Lansing labor activities and some Michigan things going back maybe to the late 30s, certainly the 40s and 50s. And then there's some other things we did. And then Ken and I brought together a group of some of the leaders of the Allied industrial workers going back into the 40s and more of them in the 60s through the 80s and did a group interview with them, and then we've subsequently done some others. And so that's why I mentioned there's a possibility of either some academic papers or maybe some other kind of video. And so the last page mentions some of those sort of things. So I think, Ken.
Okay, well listen, I'll just go ahead and give everybody a quick overview of the history of the union so they get a fairly general idea as to what we're talking about and the size of it. I just wanted to show this. I don't know how well this shows up, but this is a t-shirt that is from local... have it here. It's in Grand Haven anyway, and it was their 50th anniversary party in 1990, and I was over there for that. I just happened to see that in the drawer, and there was a lot of camaraderie. Within our unions, because we were a smaller international union.
Maybe I want to give a quick background, because I'm not sure where you're going next. For those that aren't familiar, the AFL was not America's first federation. Depends on how you want to look at it. Many people think of the Knights of Labor as the first federation of disparate unions. But the AFL comes along with a different name in 1881, and then with that name in 1886. And it goes on all of the time, and in today's world, we see AFL-CIO. From the period of 1935 until 1955, the CIO is really a second labor movement in America, a second large one at that time. There had been the Wobblies or the IWW from 1905 through some point in the 20s. There were various independents at different points. Different unions like the machinist or mine workers might be part of the AFL or separate. But it's in this time period of sort of the 30s that we have the beginnings of national groupings of auto worker labor leaders coming together. And they originally do that within the auspices of the AFL. There's then a committee within the AFL pushing industrial unionism, which later becomes the separate Congress of Industrial Organizations, which will all merge in 1955. But sorry, Ken, I just wanted to...
No, that's fine, because it takes us exactly where we want to be. Because prior to 1935 or so, and there was a constant fight within the American Federation of labor as to whether or not to organize so-called general laborers, the assembly line workers and so forth, because there were established within many industries craft unions such as the electricians, the plumbers, the millwrights, and so forth. And they each bargained for their own craft. Nobody spoke for the general grunt labor, so to speak. And there was a growing spirit that we needed to involve all workers. And that was the industrial union fight that developed in the late 20s and going into the 30s. And And John is quite right. American Federation of Labor established a process to meet this as calling for federal labor unions. And then finally, in 1935, because the federal labor unions that had been established within the auto plants in particular and the auto parts plants were not effective unions yet, they chartered the United Automobile Workers, and the first charter was issued in August 26 of 1935. And that went to the parent union of the current UAW, which basically our union, meaning the, and well, I just want to go ahead. And then from about 1935 to around 1939, there was one UAW, and it was originally an AFL union. And then in 1937, 36 and 37, the Committee of Industrial Organizations, later called the Congress of Industrial Organizations, or the CIO, was formed. Now, there was a faction within the allied with within the UAW, the original UAW, who allied themselves with the CIO faction. And there ended up to be a split within the union. The elected officers were basically from the original union, but the rump group, or the CIO group, all of a sudden got very energetic, with a lot of it being stoked here, there in Detroit, with leadership like Walter Ruther, who came along a little bit later in that fight. But he was a very strong labor union, a very strong organizer, as you all know. And eventually, there were two conventions in 1939, one in Detroit, which was the UAW AFL, and one in Cleveland, which was the CIO group. And at that point, there were two UAWs in many plants, and there was dual representation. In 1941, I believe it was Ford, held elections in the Ford plants throughout the country, and the CIO faction took the majority of those, and eventually all of the big three auto works, plus American Motors over in Kenosha, Wisconsin, all went into the CIO. And that left the UAW-AFL as the smaller union of around 40 to 50,000 members. Now, that was kind of an interesting period because had constant fights between the AFL and the CIO unions. They would both organize plants and grapple for the workers, and with a majority winning out. The CIO UAW became a lot larger, as you all know. I keep calling us the Allied Industrial Workers. We aren't there yet. The UAW AFL continued on, and it stayed strong in certain areas, in Western Michigan mainly, due to leadership like Les Washburn of Lansing, and in Wisconsin, out of guys like George Keebler, we had strong UAW AFL units in places like Briggs and Stratton, Harley Davidson, Johnson Controls, where the old union still maintains memberships.
Can I interrupt for a second, Ken?
Go ahead.
Thanks. Because we didn't have a chance to look at the visuals, I'm sorry. So we're at different paces. As Ken's describing this, for those that aren't labor historians, and there are a few in the room that are well-versed in this, but some may not be. There was this real struggle between both the AFL and the CIO in general, and some of it, a good hunk of it, is over this question of craft organization versus industrial organization, as Ken alluded to. But then you had struggles within unions also. And the UAW uniquely had this sort of Donnybrook struggle that at times would be, and Dr. Lisa Fine's chapter 3 or whatever, and a few other books really go into, some of it would be labeled about communist versus Lovestoneite. Some of it might be labeled about corruption. There are different ways that people blamed or labeled each other in these sort of things. But so within the United Auto Workers, you had this kind of a split, and it played out differently here. And so this visual, for example, from 36, the AFL had set up an auto workers group, and I've shown a couple pictures, and I'm not going to go back. This is when the local level leadership, speaking for the membership, kind of sets aside the AFL's decision making and says, we're going to have a real union, and we're going to have our own leaders. And so Dylan, a guy named Collins before him, were kind of set aside, and new officers were elected. And in the middle here, and in several of the other pictures that I've shown, is this gentleman, Homer Martin, who later most historians would say was an excellent preacher, and that's really what his training was in. And he was an awful administrator, and he made a variety of very bizarre or stupid decisions at different times. But he ends up being the UAW-AFL when it first, this big split that Ken was just describing. So one of many pictures of Homer Martin kind of being a preacher. And in Lansing, and maybe we'll have time to come back to it later, we had this Lansing Labor Holiday, and if I have time, I'll make some comments about it later. But the leader of that is a gentleman who Ken interviewed years ago, Les Washburn, who Lisa Fine comments about in a lot of detail and uses that interview and some things that she did. He is the leader of the Lansing Amalgamated 182, which is then going to split in the late 30s, and everybody except for Motor Wheel of large plants is going to go UAW-CIO. Motor Wheel will go UAW-AFL as well as some other small ones. Rio Joe,
oh, okay.
About Rio Motor Company. So we had these conflicts going on, and I was trying to say that they were about different things. They were about personalities. They were sometimes about politics. As Ken was saying, it also mattered about regions. I think a lot of what we have found as we look at some of this is people had personal affinities to each other, knew each other. And so people in the west side of Michigan, especially in the smaller plants, stayed with this original UAW, which became UAW-AFL. And I said I wasn't going to take questions, but okay, quick.
Anything about effectiveness, immigration patterns in the 20th century?
About the AIW?
Oh,
a lot, way too much, and I'm going to hold off, Dot, because I'm not sure where I want to go with that. I'm sorry. I'll come back to it later. So Ken was starting to talk about some of those kind of conflicts. This book of many books written about the UAW-CIO, what we think of the UAW, to me is kind of got the most about Homer Martin and some of those split issues. Lichtenstein's book on Reuther is excellent, and several others are. But the point is, a lot has been written about the UAW-CIO. Hardly anything has ever been written about the loser, the UAW-AFL. And this at Ford was a sign by those who won. Ford had a representation election run by the National Labor Relations Board. Ford was the largest auto factory in the United States, if not the world, at different points of time, maybe 100,000 World War II era. In 41, it's organized, and the CIO gets 70% of the votes cast. The UAW-AFL, which will later be the Allied Industrial Workers, gets 28%. And of course, we mostly have focused on that, And the Ford Agreement was a very unique and a special contract in that it was the first one in American auto, large one, that provided union security, which is what right to work no longer allows in Michigan and some other places, meaning everybody who has jobs in certain classifications will join the union or pay some kind of fee. Chrysler and GM had been organized earlier. Other places had been organized, but this was the first place, and it got a lot of attention because it had that. And of course, Walter Reuther gets lots of attention, especially here in Michigan, but all the different ways in which the UAW-CIO really had all of the large factories. And for those that aren't familiar, when I got involved in 76 in Michigan Labor Relations, you had some plants in Flint with 20,000 plus members. Lansing had one that was around 15,000 members. And there were many of these, and we have someone in the room who knows that history well because he worked on his dissertation about that. And I don't know if we'll get you to talk, but anyways, the AIW was in smaller places. I think when I first came in, Motor Wheel had maybe 3,000 members. Before it finally closed, it had maybe 300. So in this picture, which I believe, and I'll let Ken take over, is the list of the first presidents of the UAW-AFL. Homer Martin is there on the far left. This guy, Irvin Carey, next, and then Lester Washburn, the gentleman who helped create the Lansing Amalgamated 182 that Oldsmobile, Fisher Body split off and become 652, 602, et cetera, but Motor Wheel stays 182, later becomes the president of the International Union. Is that okay, Ken?
Yeah, and I do want to hark back to the Lansing labor holiday, but I'll do that in just a sec. I just want to fill out the profile of the Allied Industrial Workers. And in 1955, after the merger of the AFL and the CIO into one federation, the UAW-AFL changed its name to the Allied Industrial Workers. And that was the name that we had from 1955 on. In 1993, the union merged with the paper workers. And then in 2005, it merged, the paper workers merged with the steel workers. So now I am a retired steel worker. So things come rather, but that's the story of the Allied Industrial Workers. At its peak, about 1979, it had 100,000 members. In the period of around the middle 50s, it had 60,000. Frankly, beginning in the 80s, when the plants started leaving Michigan and Wisconsin, and Ohio and Indiana, where we had a lot of our memberships, of course, the membership declined. So that's the overview of the Allied Industrial Workers Union and its existence from 1935 until 1993. That's approximately 58 years, I guess. Anyway, the Lansing Labor Holiday is a very interesting thing, which gives you a tone of the thing. It was in 1937, I forget the exact date, but there had been a strike at Capital City Wrecking Company, a very small unit where the company refused to recognize the union and bargain, even though they had been elected in. And there had been a big strike. They'd brought, and under the leadership of Lester Washburn, who was then at 182, acting as kind of an organizer, they brought in a lot of people to help out on the picket lines. The company went and got an injunction, which is very easy for companies to get in those days, to enjoin the strikers from picketing. At that point, they kept it up in violation of the injunction. Les Washburn was at that time had to go down to Detroit for something. And he describes coming home in his interview. I'm going to read a short paragraph. I came back, and there was a knock on the door, and they said, warrants for myself and my wife. I wasn't home. I was in a board meeting in Detroit. I came back on the late train, took a cab home because it was that late, got home, and the cops had already been there. So there was this neighborhood girl watching our kids. They were small at that time. The neighborhood girl was bawling her head off, and so I asked her, what was the trouble? And she said, they came and arrested your wife. And so I went to the phone to get a hold of the guy that represented us, and it was dead. She says they cut the phone line. So that actually happened. And so those were the kind of things that went on at that time.
So can I move you forward a little bit to, you did an interview with Les Washburn. You got to know him many years after he had been president, but you talked about way back to the beginning, how and why he got involved in the union. Chapter 3 or whatever it is in Lisa's book gives a lot of background pulled from there about Les Washburn. But I wondered if you would talk a little about what you learned from him in terms of this conflict and then take us into the union corruption, or we're going to run out of time.
Yes, right. You are correct. Like, we got 7 minutes. And so I will... Yeah, Les became a leader of our of the UAW AFL at that time. He was on the executive board, and there was one of the major disputes at that time was the claim by the AFL side that the CIO side by then, which had included the leadership of the Ruther brothers, was that they were communists. That was, of course, a common phrase in those days. Washburn was a fervent anti-communist. And he tells of going to a meeting in New York City, representing President Homer Martin at that time, to meet with Norman Thomas. I hope most of you know who Norman Thomas was as the great socialist leader at that time. Because the story was that Norman Thomas was going to come out and support the AFL force group over the CIO group. But Washburn came away very disappointed because Thomas apparently did not fall for debate and stayed neutral in those fights. But that communist, anti-communist thing, flavor was very strong in those days. Our union, and I don't personally have to share this background with any pride, was of the fervent anti-communist crowd. And I'm not sure that was the best course. That was history then. The union had a very loose leadership from the national level. And in that bred some trouble, and there was principal corruption in two areas that developed in the late 40s and early 50s. One was a man by the name of Angelo Inciso, working out of Chicago, and who created an amalgamated local there where he had a scheme of selling insurance. And it was a matter of mixing in the insurance fund monies with the dues monies, which was in violation of law at that time. He was involved with the mob, as far as history tells us, and had gotten into company unionism, into all sorts of unsavory behaviors. Also, there came the opportunity by our secretary treasurer at that time, a brilliant guy by the name of Angelo Doria, who came out of the Briggs & Stratton plant in Milwaukee, and he a very talented fellow, but he saw an opportunity to organize the taxi cab drivers in New York City, who at that time were kind of involved with a mob headed by a guy by the name of Johnny Deal or Johnny Deogardo. And we set up, unfortunately at that point, it was very mob related, and there was some terrible corruption going on at that time. I won't go into the details other than to say it was true. The union in the late 55 and 56 became a principal subject of the McClellan hearings that went on in Washington, D.C., along with the Teamsters and the Fern Leather Workers and a few other unions who were accused of corruption. And at the end of that period of time, the AFL-CIO picked these various unions out for various reasons, the AIW amongst them. Our union was put under receivership from the National Union and Super. We agreed to hold a reform convention, which we held in summer 1957 in St. Louis. 5 months, and we elected new officers throughout basically the old board, and the reform movement took over. The principal lesson to be learned by all this is that from that point on, in 1957, and the receivership was lifted after 5 months, became welcome back to the House of Labor. The only union that did that at that time. The others decided to stay independent and handle them themselves differently. We like to say we were clean, efficient, and a well-run unit. And I think that was true right to the end. We are very proud of that union. And we serviced our members with great attention. We had a number of innovations that we worked on in safety.
Hold a second, Ken. I wanted you to go there, but I just wanted to speed a second here. Ken was saying, in the AIW, the corruption charges were rather modest. There was a paper local in New York City, paper meaning nobody really belonged. Somebody was collecting some money, both maybe from people who drove cabs, as well as employers, as well as maybe the mob. There was also problems in Chicago. There are several things that go on, but they're not anywhere near the rising of the Teamsters problems. And books like this have gone into this history. This has two good sections about the AIW. And of course, Hoffa in this picture is next to a labor leader from New Jersey who most people would say is probably more a mob leader than a labor leader. And the Teamsters have some very serious issues. As Ken was saying, there were activities within the AFL and activities within the what will become the Allied Industrial Workers to look at this. And in fact, in this proceedings of 1957, I found the resolution where the executive board says, due to some corrupt influences, we're going to direct to these be eliminated, and we're going to put this union under some kind of observation by what is now the AFL-CIO, having been created in 1955. And it's not much longer before they're on probation And then in that same fall, they end the probation, having done some things internally that Ken was quickly mentioning to try to improve those kind of practices. Interestingly, a lot of people who stay with it, and I've asked Ken this in several interviews that we've been doing, probably stay with it because they're good, loyal trade unionists who believe in the members and making work better for the members and that sort of thing. Not much different than others in UAW-CIO or other kinds of unions. And they're able to get rid of some of the people who weren't doing as well. And Ken mentioned there's a special convention. And of course, after the merger of the AFL-CIO, they no longer want two UAWs, two of anything. And so the UAW-AFL becomes the Allied Industrial Workers. And Ken made some comments in terms of that. Picture of Meany, Reuther with his brother, and then the merger picture with Meany and Reuther from 55. In Michigan and Wisconsin, some other states, mergers didn't happen as quick. And I don't know all the details in terms of AIW's role, but here's the merger convention proceedings from Michigan, 58. One of the things that the AFL-CIO does is when they join together, Walter Reuther and George Meany both became the heads of their two federations in 52. Reuther becomes the vice president in the AFL-CIO, but most importantly, he becomes head of the Industrial Union Department. And one of the things is the AIW, as I've learned from Ken and some other people in staff, was partly because I think they're a smaller union, they get very involved in this coordinated bargaining, where they work with unionists from the UAW, the steel workers, the machinists, et cetera, and try to bargain in a cooperative, coordinated union way with some of their employers. And so here's proceedings from that group. And then, Ken, you were going to say some things about AIW innovations?
I'm sorry, John?
You started, I interrupted you when you started talking about AIW innovations in bargaining, health or safety or outreach.
Well, I didn't want to take up any more time because it is 1 o'clock. And I think the point also about the corruption, I just want to add one point on that. It did not affect our service and the union's honesty and everything in places like Western Michigan, in Wisconsin, in the other areas. It was strictly a problem with the International Secretary Treasurer and the one officer down in Chicago. And most people were very loyal to the union, and unfortunately, the economics were such by the 1990s that merger was the only result. And that was practically all due to the loss of industry in states like Wisconsin, Michigan, and so forth. I'm very proud of the 24 years I put in at the Allied Industrial Workers. They were worthwhile years, and I think the union did well by its members. We're very happy to be part of the steel workers, which are a very progressive union, of course.
So, Ken, the picture...
I think we're probably open for whatever questions or anything you wish to ask.
Yes, we are.
Thank you for hearing me.
Thank you, Ken. Thank you, John. Let's open it up to questions.
Go right ahead.
It wasn't clear to me why, when the UAW formed, why people wanted a second union still affiliated with the AFL.
So, Ken, the question, did you hear it or you want me to repeat
it? No, I couldn't hear it very well.
Okay. Why, when the majority of the large plants and others go with the CIO among the auto workers, why do some people end up staying with Homer Martin, Les Washburn, and others in this UAW-AFL?
Well, I think the basic reason from my point of view, is that that a bunch of the leadership on the executive board split off and took along with it some recognized leaders like Wyndham Mortimer, Dick Frankenmuth, and so on and so forth, George Addis, and a few of those guys. And Walter Reuther had done a great work, along with folks at Local 6 there in Detroit. And I think the other reason why they went more to the CIO was the inept leadership of Homer Martin. Homer had become very fervently anti-communist, as I was saying, and doctrinaire and dictator-like in his leadership style. And all of that really, I think, helped to motivate the CIO, which was, in a sense, the Rising Young Turks. And I think that was most of the explanation why the larger auto plant locals went CIO. Those that stayed with the AFL group, as John stated earlier, were those that had a particular affinity with the local leadership. As I stated, we had a strong leadership in Northeast Ohio, Cincinnati area, Milwaukee, and Western Michigan, and so forth.
And so the picture I'm showing up now is from the special edition you did, and I can't remember the year. I don't have it in front of me.
It was 1986.
Thank you. Which lists some of the major firms, and the only major firm of automobile production is Checkers Motors in that list over in Kalamazoo. Otherwise, all of the assembly plants went with the large UAW CIO. But smaller places like Motor Wheel here or some of these others stayed with their original leadership. And I think both Ken and I and some other historians would say it's because a lot of it is about relationships. And if you believe that a Les Washburn or some of the people in these other locales was a good unionist and they had decided to stay with this UAW-AFL, and you thought that person was helping improve your wages, starting to get health benefits, pensions, or other things, and you felt that affinity from time that you've been working together, you'd go ahead and stay with them. Does that answer your question, or you still don't?
Well, the question was, why are these local leaders? Was it because they wanted to keep their own power and perks and they didn't want to go with
them? So, Ken, I tried to say too quickly earlier, I think it's all the above. I think for some individuals, it's about political things. But I think for a lot, that's just an excuse for other things that are going on. And I think, like you just said, for some people, it's simply, if you're already the leader in this place, then you might stay. But many of the people who were original UAW that go CIO or whatever, they stay in leadership. So you could merge, if you took your whole group over to the CIO, well, you're probably going to stay there in what position. So I don't think that's as much, although there were, like you said, a few corrupt people.
So why some did and some didn't?
Yeah, and we'd have to, I think, look at each one of these kind of locations, these factories, these firms, and try to sort some of those out. And I know some of the Michigan ones, and Ken knows some of the Wisconsin ones very well and from some of our interviews, but I think that's probably as far as I can go with that question. Ken, go ahead.
I would like to just add one point in kind of support of the questioner, and that is, I do believe that a lot of the problems of the labor movement is that lies in its basic democracy. That sounds weird. But it's just like all of the congressmen now are worried about their primary elections. So sometimes they take positions that maybe they don't fully believe in, but they know will solidify them with their particular base. And I think in answer to your question, there certainly was a selfish motive staying in power that motivates a lot of what we do in our society. So I would agree with him in that sense, yes.
Go ahead.
How many were the overall membership?
Could you repeat the number? What was the largest for UAW-AFL and the largest for Allied Industrial Workers in total membership?
Well, the UAW-CIO, I forget their peak, but it was around 2 million, I believe.
No, UAW-AFL. What was their largest and what was AIW's?
Our peak was a little over 100,000, and that was in 1979.
Okay. The UAW's peak was 1.5 million in 1977.
And I guess a comment in the question, wouldn't that greatly diminish your bargaining leverage, and how did the contracts compare with the UAW labor agreements?
And Ken, I'm going to cut in because I think we both would agree on this. I looked at this Lansing situation, okay, and I put, I think, some answers that directly go to this, to the contracts that existed here in town. And I've looked at some contracts that existed in UAW-CIO or UAW-AFL-CIO that were not big plants. That is, they're part suppliers, they're smaller operations. And quite frankly, I think there's a lot of similarity between them and AIW contracts for the years. And that's been sort of my sense. These are pictures about Lansing and the local here. This is a contract from the Lansing Motor Wheel, meaning what state is UAW-AFL 182 in 1941. And at that point, the pay rate is 75 cents per hour for men and women. And for 1941, that was somewhat a progressive stand because there were still, in many factories of both the AFL and CIO type, separate pay scales and so forth for women workers. And so that was the one in 41. A little higher for skilled trades in 41. You can see grinding's $1, $1.14, so forth. 47, so 6 years later at the same motor wheel, we're up to $1.15.5. Per hour for men and women, and then it goes on and talks again after you've been there 30 or more days, it's $1.20.5. Couple of years later, same plant for skilled trades, we're $1.60 to $1.85. Interesting thing about night work, senior men shall not be required to work second or third shift to exceed 60 days. One of the things we're trying to look at is to compare some of these kind of clauses across and see how much there is similarity. And part of my reason for mentioning about this comparison is it really because of what the union was, or is it because of the size of the plant or the size of the company and those sort of things? So the same sort of thing that's going on even today within the UAW about a second or third tier, you always had kind of the big, what we used to call the big three, the Detroit three tier, and then you had different tiers for parts suppliers. And really smaller parts suppliers, I would argue, weren't much different than AIW, steelworkers, and some others in auto parts supply. Does that get to the question?
Yeah, it just would seem to me that they would have to have some of the contracts or there wouldn't be a move from
CIO. Yeah. Right. So, can these pick?
I would just add, too, that one of the things that we worked on very hard was the coordinated bargaining thing. So we had, meant when we were dealing with Kelsey Hayes or Clark Equipment, that the machinists and steelworker locals and the auto worker locals that represented their various plants, we'd get together and try to coordinate language. And most of our contracts turned out to be fairly similar.
So I would suggest this by the 74 contract at Motor Wheel, after what had been kind of a big issue locally about police brutality, how long Motor Wheel was now part of a larger corporation and they no longer were kind of a local thing. There was a lot of issues. But if you looked at these wages and hours, and it's one of the things I'm trying to do and compare them with comparable industries or within the parts supply industry, I think you'd see a lot of similarity. Whether or not they're identical, I'm not certain. That would be a different question. So, Ken, we have a minute left. Anything else you would like to add?
No, just thank them for their patience for listening to me from here.
Well, thank you very much for joining us again. And any last questions, or we're... Looks like we're all set. So thank you very much, Ken.
All righty. You guys have a good one.